800-282-3255. Remember, the heart of the matter is the heart. So guard your heart.
You've been listening to Viewpoint with Chuck Crismier. Viewpoint is supported by the faithful gifts of our listeners. Let me urge you to become a partner with Chuck as a voice to the church declaring vision for the nation. Join us again next time on Viewpoint as we confront the issues of America's heart and home.
This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at and that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality and not illusion or delusion that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you listen to. They happen to be my views, and well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of our good friend Ron Brown. Hi, Ron, how are we doing?
Just fine, Dr. Stan.
Well, certainly we're living in exciting times, aren't we?
Yeah, that ought to be a little scary, but that's exactly where we are.
Well, I think it's important for people to understand that the government is simply lying to us just about everything. They tell us, oh, isn't it wonderful, the unemployment level is dropping and it went from 7.8% to 7.7%. Well, certainly you don't have to take my word for what's really going on. You need to read Mr. Zuckerman. Now, Mr. Zuckerman, Board Zuckerman, member of the Trilateral Commission, member of the Council on Foreign Relations, he is certainly one of the leaders of our country from the other side, but of course he publishes U.S. News and World Report. You can go to his website and he will tell you things are terrible as far as the employment situation is concerned, and he will tell you that they're simply deceiving you as far as the level of unemployment, and that if you use the U6 unemployment figures, you're dealing with well over 14% unemployment rate. That's the unemployed. That is the underemployed, people working half-time or a couple of half-time jobs, and the people have simply given up looking for work. And then we have another 12 or 11 million people on disability. We only had about 5 million on disability. When Obama came to office, the others have simply come on. They can't get a job, so they go on disability. We have a real problem here in America. Things are not getting better economically, and the Obama administration is just lying to us. What are your thoughts on that, Ron?
Oh, absolutely. You know, we've been going through this boom and bust, and things keep getting worse. They keep telling us it's getting better, and they have to lie more and more to keep the system afloat. And so they're quickly running out of rabbits. More and more people are waking up, especially overseas, where people are refusing to accept the dollar now, and the dollar's status as a reserve currency is being threatened. In fact, it's being displaced and replaced very gradually by China and the other countries. You know, a lot of us read something the other day that said 37% of world trade is not denominated in dollars anymore. So the dollar's losing its status, and when we lose that status, then our ability to borrow from the rest of the world, which we've already lost, but all the dollars that have been loaned to us over the last 30, 40, 50, 60 years are going to start coming back, flooding our shores as people dump dollars hand over fist. And that's starting to accelerate as we speak.
Well, you know, the thing is that most people don't understand that the only thing that's keeping our economy afloat at all is the fact that the Federal Reserve System is pouring almost $100 billion, actually $85 billion of money into our economy every single month. And they're keeping the interest rates very much lower than they should be. But basically that means, of course, that if you're retired and you're dependent upon interest income, bank or bonds, why, of course, you're not going to get very much in the way of income. And this is really hurting the elderly. Certainly you're not getting a fair response on your income. You're having more inflation than the interest rates you're getting. But basically what you have to understand is that certainly the economy is doing very, very poorly. They're pouring $85 billion of borrowed money into our economy every single month just to try to keep it afloat with no end in sight. Our guest is Ron Brown. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you got a question or comment, don't hesitate to call, but because we're going to be talking about finance this hour. And contrary to everything you're hearing, they're simply lying to you. If they stop pouring all that money into the economy, I fear it would collapse. We'll be back in just a moment.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
You may have heard about the 90 essential nutrients or the Mighty 90 needed for good health. But with all the products out there, what exactly are they talking about? The Mighty 90 is 16 vitamins, 12 amino acids, 60 plant-derived minerals, and 2 essential fatty acids. So, now you know. But with all the products you see and hear advertised, what exactly do you buy to come up with the Mighty 90 and the right ratios to promote good health? Youngevity has made it easy with the Healthy Start Pack, which contains one canister of Beyond Tangy Tangerine Vitamin and Plant-Derived Mineral Complex, one bottle of Bone and Joint Enriching OsteoFX Plus, and one bottle of EFA Plus Essential Fatty Acids, all in the proper ratios to promote good health and vitality. For more information or to order, call 1-800-991-8730. That's 1-800-991-8730 and ask about business opportunities.
You may be new to freeze-dried foods. You may have storable food questions. You may want to buy your freeze-dried foods from a very reputable company and not go broke in the process. Welcome to the Freeze-Dry Guy. Okay, actually, we're more than just one guy. We're a California-based company that's been serving our U.S. military and other government agencies with the finest in freeze-dried storable foods and emergency rations since 1970. See all about us at freezedryguy.com. With Freeze-Dry Guy freeze-dried foods, you can and will be ready for just about any unexpected crisis. Freeze-dried guy foods are delicious, require little preparation, and will taste just as fresh decades from now as they do today. Just add hot water and serve. Backpackers consistently rate us number one year after year as the best tasting and ease of preparation. Isn't that what you want for your family? Visit freezedryguy.com or call 866-404-FOOD. That's 866-404-3663 or go to freezedryguy.com. Freeze-Dry Guy, the best you can buy.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Ron is simply talking about the two major rules that we have. And first of all, the golden rule, he who has the gold rules. And then, of course, the second rule is the borrower becomes slave to the lender. And basically, ladies and gentlemen, we're borrowing money. Well, they have to borrow money so that the Fed can actually come up with $85 billion a month to try to prop up our economy. But people throughout the world realize, of course, that America is not only morally bankrupt, it's financially bankrupt. And we're creating money out of nothing. We're just creating money artificially. We're lending it to the European Central Bank. We're lending money throughout the world, trying to keep the economy afloat, I think, until the coming war. And then, of course, they'll collapse the whole thing. They'll blame the war and they'll say, see, it's not our fault. But what's really happening, of course, is we are totally subservient to the banks. The banks certainly run the government. The banks own the reserve. The Federal Reserve is not a government agency. It is a privately owned central bank. And who owns the privately owned central banks? We have six major banks in America, J.P. Morgan Chase. Certainly we have Morgan Stanley. We have Citigroup. We have Goldman Sachs. Wells Fargo, and Bank of America. Those six banks own 69%, almost 70% of all the financial assets of the banking system. That's less than 0.2% of the 0.2% of all the banks in America own almost 70% of all the assets. And it's not that suddenly they are controlled by the government. They control the government. They're too big to fail. Suddenly, and the government does everything they can to prop them up. And basically, what is happening today is that the central bank, the Fed, is actually pouring $40 billion every single month into the big banks to stabilize them and to get them out from underneath all the fraudulent mortgage bonds that they're holding. In other words, you and I are bailing out the richest banks in the world. Go right ahead, Ron.
Okay, what I was saying is that gold and silver is the barometer of confidence. So the banks have to hold it down to, because if they don't, it's like sending a message to the whole world, there's something wrong in River City. Now, as long as you get the price of gold and silver off these commodity exchanges where you're trading paper contracts, these Western bankers can manipulate that market till the cows come home. But here's their Achilles heel. Every time they drive the price of gold down or silver, the kings of the East, China in particular, Russia, India, and so forth, they all get this big old Cheshire Cat grin on their face, and they say, gosh, we appreciate the discount. Why don't you just ship us another 5 or 10 or 20 million ounces of the real stuff? And to support that, John Embry and a lot of the analysts have been saying for a while that China's imports last year were 1,000 tons of gold. But as you know, Dr. Stan, my favorite analyst is Jim Willie, and he has contacts all over the world coming out of Europe and the East and China and everything. And he says their true imports were somewhere between 5 and 7,000 tons. Now, 1,000 tons would be about 40% of world production, but 5 to 7,000 tons would be 2 to 3 times world production. So that should raise a question to all of us. Where in the heck is all of that gold coming from? But also, we got to ask the question, how long can one country or several countries continue to import that much gold without collapsing the system? And two, the fact that they're importing it that fast now tells me that they see the end game in sight, and there is no longer two steps forward, one step back. They're trying to get as much as they can as fast as they can. So when you start asking the question, where is that gold coming from, that's when all these frauds start to be exposed. As one example, Germany several months ago said we'd like to get our gold back from London and New York, and they had something like 3,350 tons of gold, supposedly. And we told them, well, we can only give you a fifth of that, 20 tons, but we're going to do it over 5 years. Excuse me, 7 years. So what did they really just say? We don't have the gold. We think we can scrape up a little bit each year to appease you, but even if we can't, we at least kick the can down the road another year. So you've got all sorts of countries demanding their gold. There's dozens of lawsuits coming out of Europe of rich millionaires, you know, class action suits of people who have gold stored in these Western banks, and they're trying to get it out, and they can't get it. And then we've got this rehypothecation scandal. In other words, we're about to see the biggest monetary scandal in the world when the world finally wakes up that anyone sitting there holding a piece of paper thinking they have gold, the only gold that really counts is what you have in your hand.
And I think the interesting thing that people really don't understand is that China wants to have the reserve currency of the world. They want their currency to replace the American currency, and that means all transactions would have to be in the Chinese yuan. Well, basically, of course, what they're doing is they're accumulating the gold. They know exactly what they're doing. It's the golden rule. He who has the gold rules, and this is the direction we're heading, and there is the government, the United States government, which claims it has the gold, could not actually provide the gold for the Germans when they asked to have it repatriated, because they wanted the gold, they want something behind their currency, rather than simply paper, and we told them, well, it'll be 7 years, and you can only have a certain limited amount. Ladies and gentlemen, we are in real financial problems. And instead of that, instead of talking about the real problems that face America, what do we talk about? Well, we talk about Madonna and Lady Gaga, and we talk about certainly this or that sporting event. They do not want us to stop and understand. They don't want you to stop and understand, because most people, I believe, are going to get wiped out totally financially and impoverished when this whole house of cards comes down and they destroy the value of our currency. And everything you have, certainly in a pension fund, certainly in a retirement fund, you even have insurance denominated in dollars that will become worthless. And basically, of course, people do not understand that this, I believe, is happening intentionally, not by accident. They know exactly what they're doing, because, of course, when you have a free and prosperous people, you can't enslave them. But when you have people who are impoverished and don't know where the next meal is coming from, they'll do whatever they're told to do. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295 if you're out there across America, you have a question or comment, or Ron Brown, or Eric, because basically, ladies and gentlemen, I think we're moving into extremely difficult times. The unemployment rate is far higher than they're telling you. Certainly, the production is not going up. The old idea that figures don't lie, but liars can figure, certainly can be well seen as they keep telling us how the economy is improving. But it really isn't improving. Yes, about 80% of the people are working and have a fixed income, but there's about 20, probably, according to John Williams, about 22% under unemployment or underemployment in the United States today. And more people are simply giving up looking for work, and they're getting on Social Security disability, not because they're disabled, but because they need a source of income, and the government's all too glad to give it to them as long as they can continue doing it on borrowed money. We're borrowing over $1 trillion every single year. Remember, it took us 200 years to run up $1 trillion in debt, and now we've increased the debt well over $1 trillion every single year. Our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 464-8295. Our guest, Ron Brown. And what are your thoughts, Ron?
Well, you know, it's important to remember that China and the Eastern Bloc nations want to replace the U.S. and Western civilization as the powers of the world. So China does not want to collapse the system. They just want to take charge of it. So they're willing to go along with these bankers and let them manipulate the price down, and then they'll just demand delivery. Now, there will reach a point where they say, we've squeezed as much blood out of that turnip as we're going to get. Now let's pull the plug on these bankers. And they're setting the stage for that right now. For example, China has just opened up the Chinese Gold and Silver Exchange, which is a commodity exchange to compete with London and New York for the pricing of gold. So in the future, whenever China is ready to pull the plug on us, they will use arbitrage to collapse these Western bankers. In other words, the Western bankers have to force the price down artificially by ambushing it in the paper markets. But once you have that Chinese exchange and the New York market is pushed down artificially, arbiters will see the opportunity. They'll just buy gold on the COMEX or the London Exchange and immediately sell it on the Chinese Exchange, which has fallen right in the Chinese hand, just shipping more and more gold to them. But eventually, Morgan Chase and these bankers will be forced to default on those contracts. And when they default, that will not only destroy the Western banking system, it'll destroy the credibility of New York and London as the money centers of the world. And that power and prestige then will be transferred over to the East. So it's a long, methodical process that they're doing. It's up and down, two steps forward, one step back. But they're approaching the end game, in my opinion. I think we're getting very, very close.
And, of course, the people who founded this country, you go back and read what Thomas Jefferson said about the danger of the banking system, and what John Adams and James Madison said about the danger of an irresponsible banking system, and how the bankers could simply exploit the system to their own benefit, but they could also end up destroying the value of our currency. And almost everything, certainly the people have saved, is in one form or another in savings that is somehow related to the dollar. And, of course, you destroy the value of the dollar. You destroy the value of people's life savings. And this is why we plead with people, make your preparations. We don't know when this is going to come down. It could come down tomorrow. It could come down a year from now. It could come down 5 years from now. But there's not a question of if, it's a matter of when it is coming down. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Our guest is Ron Brown. We're certainly talking about the financial crisis that is certainly consuming our financial markets. And everything is being done so that you will not see clearly what's happening. But they're giving you all sorts of fraudulent information. Oh, things are getting better. Look how much better we are. Look how the unemployment benefit is falling. Ladies and gentlemen, the unemployment level is not falling. It's just more and more people are dropping out. And when you drop out of the labor force, they just quit counting you. Our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Give us a call.
Your body is composed of literally trillions of cells. Cells are the building blocks of energy and performance for your health and for the life you want to live. Nutritional Therapeutics, a trusted manufacturer of vitamin supplements, understands that when cells aren't operating at optimum levels, one of the immediate signs is an increase in fatigue. Propax is a daily multiple vitamin enhanced with our proprietary formula called NT Factor. Less fatigue equals more natural energy. Propax with NT Factor addresses cellular damage and gives you health from nature, energy from science. Call today at 1-800-982-9158. Try Propax with NT Factor. Call 1-800-982-9158. Order yours today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, or cure, or prevent any disease.
Americans love pills. America's 40 million seniors will have consumed 1.6 trillion pills during their lifetime, not counting vitamin pills. This is health journalist Bill Sardi. Americans are living longer an additional 18 years after they reach age 65. How will senior Americans spend that time? You've got it. Taking more and more pills to treat more and more disease. We need a better approach. How about a pill that promotes health rather than treats disease? That's where a pill I formulated comes in. It's called Longevinix, and it's a well-tested combination of herbs and vitamins proven to trigger genes activated by a limited-calorie diet, even mimicking physical exercise. Longevinix promotes healthy vision, heart pumping, immune response, blood clotting, and even mood. Call 1-866-405-4000 to order today. Healthy aging, Longevinix. Get started before you grow old. Call now, 1-866-405-4000.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll-free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
Do you enjoy cooking? Would you like to learn the culinary secret that Barbara uses to enhance the flavor of Dr. Stan's food? Who's Barbara? She's Dr. Stan's wife. And what's her secret? She uses the delicious spices produced by Old Westport Spice and Trading Company. After using and enjoying their products for almost 20 years, Dr. Stan and Barbara decided they should offer their favorites to you. If you would like to please your family and enhance the flavor of your food, call 800-544-8927. That's 800-544-8927. I suggest you call today. Once again, the telephone number is 800-544-8927. 800-544-8927.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest is Ron Brown. My telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And Ron, how can people get in touch with you? And if they'd like some suggestions from you as to what they should be doing now to try to protect their life savings?
Well, they can call me. My 800 number is 1-800-595-0561. 1-800-595-0561. And anyone that calls, you know, especially someone that's new to the game and doesn't really understand the need for gold and silver, what I try to do is just educate people and give them some of my background to explain why they need to protect themselves. And then to keep them in touch, what I do is people who have an email address, I read dozens of articles every week, and when I see some important ones, I'll just forward it to the people on the list to kind of keep them abreast of what's going on and how. Because, you know, if a person's only listening or watching TV or listening to the news, the Wall Street news, then they don't have a picture of what's really going on. As you've been saying, they distort things, they act like we're in an economic recovery as things continue to deteriorate. So I just try to keep people posted on what's going on.
Okay, fine. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, but we're really not in a recovery. In fact, we've never come out of the recession. You have to understand that they calculate the gross domestic product and the growth of the gross domestic product based upon the rate of inflation, and they're simply lying about the rate of inflation. So if your rate of inflation is 1%, 1.5%, maybe 2%, why, of course, we came out of the Depression. But if the rate of inflation is about 8 or 9%, and that's what it really is, why, of course, then we've never come out of the recession. We're certainly in the recession. We may even well be in a real depression. And the average American really doesn't understand that the only thing that is keeping our economy from complete collapse is funneling almost $1 trillion worth of money into the economy by the Fed every single year. Basically, you're talking about $85 billion a month. That comes to about well over $960, $970 billion. That's almost $1 trillion. They're simply pouring into the economy. Well, of course, give us a call. If you have a question or comment, it looks like we have Michael calling us from Michigan right now. And so Michael calling from Flint. And if they'll simply pass Michael over, why, we'll put him on the line here. But certainly, I think people out all across America know something's wrong. We don't like to think about it. We really wish that the economy were picking up on its own. But when you have massive debt and no way of ever paying off that debt, why, of course, you're in an impossible situation. So basically, do you think that the average individual really understands how severe the problems are, not only in America, but throughout the world? Certainly, France, Greece, Portugal, Spain, Italy, they all have these massive social welfare programs, and they don't have the money to pay for them. Here in the United States, why, we have a Social Security program. People paid into it for years, and the politicians stole the money and spent it. There is no money in the Federal Reserve System, there is no money in the Social Security account. So they have to take the money that's coming in today that you're paying in if you're working, and to give it to the people who retired. It's a Ponzi scheme. Same thing is true with Medicare, and unfortunately, why, I think very soon the day of reckoning is coming. All right. Hi, Michael. Do you have a question or comment for our guest?
Yeah, I do. I agree with you. It is a Ponzi scheme, but I want to ask Ron, how many Americans are working? How much money does the government take in, and how much are they spending?
Okay, Ron, do you have any idea how many Americans are coming in the workforce? How much money the government's making, and how much it's spending?
Well, I don't have the dollar figures right on hand, but what we do know is that the admitted deficit by the government has been running somewhere between $1.2 and $5 trillion. Which means they're spending, you know, $1.5 trillion more every year than they bring in taxes. But if you listen to John Williams and people like that, they'll tell you the true deficit is somewhere around $5 to $7 trillion a year when you take in the Social Security and all the unfunded liabilities that are being stolen, like Dr. Stan just mentioned. So
And basically that is the accumulated debt. In other words, every responsible corporation has to use the general accepted accounting principles, and you add to your debt what you owe. Well, we don't bother to do that. The federal government doesn't use GAAP, as every corporation is required. They just do it on a come in, come out, go, money in, money out. But as Ron says, the real deficit every single month is not 1.3 or 1.4 trillion. It's about $5 trillion, and the day of reckoning is coming. Give us a call if you're out there. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest is Ron Brown. We have Michael on the line calling us from Flint, Michigan. If you're out there across America, give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. But understand that certainly it took 200 years to accumulate $1 trillion in debt. Certainly Ronald Reagan was very, very critical of Jimmy Carter because he had actually accumulated $200 billion in debt in 4 years in office. And Ronald Reagan just said how irresponsible that was. But, of course, when Ronald Reagan became the president, why, because he accumulated $200 billion every year in office. And when he left office, why, the federal deficit was about $2.7 trillion. Certainly George Bush increased the federal debt about $5 trillion in 8 years. Barack Obama has increased the federal debt approximately $5.7 trillion in a period of of 4 years, and that we're going to run another $1.1 trillion deficit this year. Michael, do you have a question?
Yeah, I'm wondering what he thought about Detroit. Is bankrupt right now, and they had a city manager take over that the governor appointed. This is basically like a dictator. I forget what the word is. I think it's allegory or something.
I think he called him a conservator, but go ahead.
Yeah. They got these cities going down. They're bankrupt. There's no way Detroit's going to come back. They're so far behind, and they're in worse shape than the federal government is, and that place is a war zone down there.
Okay,
and,
now, what was your question?
So what, you know, with these cities going down, what is it that is going to happen, you know, to where, you know, what's going on with this country?
Okay.
We've got our major cities going bankrupt here.
Okay, Ron, why don't you respond to that? And once again, if you're out there in the listening audience, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And Michael's from Flint, Michigan. Of course, Detroit is close at hand. And Detroit basically is a bankrupt city. They've appointed a conservator, almost like a dictator, to take over the finances. And they've taken it away from the city council because there's no way they can raise the money. I mean, their whole blocks, whole districts of Detroit, which are so run down, they're just tearing the buildings down. And certainly they have no sound industrial base there any longer. What they do have is certainly not enough to really finance that city. Ron, what's your impression of what's going on in Detroit? What about the other cities, and where is this all going to end up?
Well, you just have to look at the whole debt situation. You know, once they created this Federal Reserve System, which meant you didn't have any gold backing or any thing to keep the politicians from create more and more money, and that's what gold does. It acts as a discipline on the politicians to keep them just running amok like they've done since we created the Fed. So what these bankers who got control of this federal system created was a system where they could create boom and bust at will, and if you know when you're going to create the boom and you know when you're going to create the bust, you can make money going both ways. So the big bankers and the big corporations and the big money people have been consolidating power for 100 years, and now, as you just said, they control, 69% of the financial assets in America. But as they do that, this debt bubble keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and now they're trapped in it, because what they cannot allow now is for interest rates to rise. You know, if you think the economy is bad now, if interest rates were allowed to rise, then it would collapse, one, the interest on the debt would just explode upward. What would happen to the economy if the interest rate on boats and cars and loans and houses were to go up dramatically? Plus, all the pension people who are holding their money in bonds would lose everything. So they're trapped where they have to hold interest rates low, and to do that, they just have to run the printing press to buy up the unwanted bonds. And when they do that, the rest of the world starts to reject us, and it's just a matter of time before the whole thing implodes. It's nothing but smoke and mirrors holding this house of cards together right now.
I think that's exactly right. Michael, does that answer your question? Basically, we're in real trouble.
One more thing is,
okay, go ahead.
Detroit was talking about going bankrupt. So if they went bankrupt, then all them pension funds and all that, I think that affects all that. And so those people lose everything when that happens, and I think that will be the next phase. I don't see this city manager being able to save this, and at some point there will be a bankruptcy, and those people will lose everything in all them different funds and stuff that they got.
And I think this is not only, of course, as far as Detroit. You see, Detroit has a lot of bonds. The city has been borrowing money to try to stay afloat, but they got to the point they can't borrow any more money. But most of the cities are selling bonds. Suddenly the government's selling bonds. You know, everybody's borrowing money. The difficulty is that there's no way it'll ever get paid back. And so, as you point out, the pension funds certainly are into buying bonds. Certainly insurance companies buy bonds. bonds. Suddenly the banks buy bonds. And if those bonds suddenly become worthless, why, what happens to the banking system? What happens to the insurance companies? What happens to the pensions? I think you're absolutely right, Michael. I share your concern. I think we're in real trouble. And I think people have to begin to look after themselves and figure this whole house of cards is on the brink of coming down. Hey, thank you for calling.
Yeah,
anything else,
Doc,
you want to say before you go?
One more thing, Doc. Hey, Doc.
Go ahead.
Okay. Just everybody recognize that Detroit is broke. There's no coming back, and so that's a major city, and so that it's totally collapsed. And everybody better wake up, because I heard L.A. and other cities are in bad shape like that too. And so, you know, the when you see smoke, there's fire, and so.
Okay.
Fire.
You're God bless, and you're absolutely right. Thank you so much. And our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. But of course, right now, of course, as long as the interest rates are low, why, the federal government can pay the interest on the bonds. But when suddenly the interest rates are forced to go up to prevent us from having runaway inflation, what does that do to the value of the bonds? It destroys the value of the bonds. Interest rates rise, value of the bonds goes down. And so if your insurance company, your pension fund, or whoever it is invest in those bonds, while they lose money, and they lose it dramatically. But the other thing that's going to happen, certainly down the line, is that they're going to progressively destroy the value of our currency through the process of inflation. They're lying about the rate of inflation today. It's much higher than they're letting you know. And all you need to do is certainly go to the grocery store and look and see what's happening to the price of vegetables and fruits and of meats and butter and milk and all of the other things. So the prices are going up progressively. But not so much so noticeable, but down the line it's going to be ever so much more noticeable. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Ron, what do you see happening in the near future, in the next, say, 6 months to a year?
Well, what I really see is that the Eastern Bloc nations are accelerating their flight out of the dollar. They've created, for example, China has created bilateral trade agreements with all sorts of countries. Let me just give you a list of them. They've created agreements with Brazil, Japan, Russia, Bolivia, Korea, Australia. Even England just developed a trade deal with China. So when you develop these trade agreements, what you're saying is we're going to circumvent trading in the dollar, and we'll just trade among each other and cut the dollar out of the equation. And as they do more and more of that, you know, China is in the meantime accumulating gold and silver, so at some point they will marry the two, that China will become the new reserve currency and back their currency with gold. At that point, any country wanting to trade internationally is going to have gold to play the game. And what Americans don't realize is that the gold is being transferred just unbelievably fast from the Western civilization to the East. You know, China, Russia, India are just accumulating gold hand over fist, and it's all part of the process to eventually jettison the dollar as the world's reserve currency. And at that point, the U.S. is up a creek without a paddle, because then all those dollars, all those debt instruments and bonds that countries around the world have held in their reserve because they're trading in dollars, they will have no reason to hold them anymore, and they will start dumping them into the market. We're already seeing that. The Fed is having to step up and buy the bonds that are being dumped into the market.
And of course, basically, of course, they're doing this to stabilize the banking system, but the banking system is really totally bankrupt. And the banks have massive debts based upon the assets that have little or no value. That's what the mortgage bonds were all about. That's why the Fed is buying the mortgage bonds from the banks, so that they can balance their books, because, of course, they're holding worthless assets. So the Federal Reserve System is buying those up to try to keep the banks from collapsing. But the last thing they want is for the American people to learn the truth. That, of course, is something the average individual should never know. Now, basically, if I was a financial advisor, advisor and telling her these things, I could get into real trouble. Why? Because they don't want financial advisors to tell people the truth. And so I'm not a financial advisor. I'm just a minor historian. I've been watching these things for 50 years, and we're coming to a climax in civilization, which is going to change the very structure of our society. And of course, this is what happens when a nation turns its back on God. When a nation turns its back on God, God turns his back on that nation and brings punishment. People, Chris, look at what's happening financially, and they look at what's happening militarily, and they look and see what's happening politically, but they never look and see what's happening spiritually. And we leave certainly all the explanations to economics without ever taking into the fact that God is the determining factor of what's really going to happen in the world and what's going to happen to America. And when a nation abandons God, God abandons that nation. Our neighbor, dial the phone numbers 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. Ron, as you talk to people out across America, do you think most of them have an idea what's really going on?
Well, the people that call me have more of an idea than the people who are not interested in what's going on in the economy. But I would say this, everyone that I talk with, they have the same problem with their family and friends that I'm sure you have, Dr. Stan. I know I have. People don't want to hear. They think it's too radical. It's too crazy, and this can't be happening. This is America. So the majority of the Americans don't want to hear what's going on. It, you know, if you think about it, if you wake up to what's going on today and you start from scratch and all of a sudden you're lambasted with the status, it scares the bejeebers out of you. So we're in basically in denial, and country just doesn't want to know what's going on.
Well, our job is, of course, to try to keep people aware, at least the people who listen to our program, so they'll have an idea what's going on. I think we have Frank calling us from Salinas, and as soon as Frank gets covered, transferred over there, and there is Frank. Hi, Frank. Do you have a question or comment?
Yeah, I have a good question. For a small, you know, retired investor with, you know, a certain amount of money, is there any value in holding Australian or China stocks, or are there any gold companies in China or India that would be of any value to hold?
All right. In other words, basically, would this be stock in a Chinese bank or stock in an Indian bank? Is this what you're suggesting?
Yeah.
Or assets there?
Yeah, just plain stocks from Australia.
Okay. What about stocks, let's say, in Australia? What about stocks in... Were you asking about China, or were you thinking more of Australia?
China, Russia.
All right, fine. What about buying stocks in other countries? What about buying stocks in Australia? What are your thoughts?
Well, in the first place, China would be considered, in my opinion, our enemy. So why, you know, China is trying to accumulate as much gold from the West as they can, so why would we trust them to be storing our gold or to be mining gold for us? I think they could just reject the foreign ownership, and we've seen what they've been doing with the gold and silver stocks. And don't get me wrong, I've always loved gold and silver shares, but that's easier for the bankers to manipulate. They can naked short these stocks, so they can ambush them, drive them down. So the shares have not kept up with even the gold, and the gold, of course, has been manipulated the last 2 years. But, you know, it's just a lot easier for the bankers to hold and suppress the price of the gold and silver shares, which they have to do for the same reason they have to suppress gold and silver, because it's the barometer of confidence in their Ponzi scheme.
You know, if you're a Frank, are you retired?
Yes.
I think you have to be very, very conservative. I talk to so many people, and suddenly they want to make a lot of money. And they want to get into the stock market. I have a very good friend back in Chicago who actually got into this surefire thing. It was a copper stock, and it was being lauded by some financial advisors that he had a great deal of confidence in. And he called me and asked me what I thought, and I said, get out of it. Get out of it now. Well, he'd lost half of his money. He didn't want to lose half of his money. And I said, get out of it. Well, he didn't do it. And he lost it. And, you know, he must be 60, 70 years old. He still has to work now, a couple of jobs, just to keep ahead. Do not try to get to actually make money at this point, to protect what you have. And certainly the best way to protect it, I would think, would be to get into gold and silver, varied, but at least have something that has inherent value. I think eventually the price is going to go up. And I would be very loath to be in the stock market at this time, unless you have money that you're prepared to lose. If you are prepared to lose it and you want to gamble, fine, but don't put most of your funds into that. What would you think about that advice, Ron?
Absolutely. In fact, when you look at shares of a stock, especially the gold and silver shares, you're really betting on a lot of variables. You're betting on the honesty and competence of the management. You're betting on the honesty of Wall Street, and we're now showing that that's a corrupt system. And you're betting on the solvency of the banking system. So you're betting on an awful lot of things. And to me, the system is so fragile and so corrupt, you're really gambling to gamble on that, the gold and silver. They're just too manipulated.
I think that's probably pretty good advice. And I certainly would want to invest in other countries. I think the whole world monetary system is simply on the edge of a cliff, and you don't want to be there with when we start to go over the cliff.
Can I ask another?
Sure, go right ahead.
How about the GLD? The gold ETF.
What about the ETF? What about the exchange traded funds?
Dr. Stan, when they first started coming out with those, what about 5 years ago? And I think I even said it on your show. I said, folks, wake up. Use your common sense. Why would Wall Street and the bankers create a new avenue for gold that would make it easy for every one of their stockbrokers to call every one of their clients and say, have we got a deal for you? You can now buy gold and silver, and you don't have to worry about storing it yourself. Now, I was saying from the very beginning that all these exchange-traded funds was just another gimmick to take legitimate demand for gold and silver and send it down the primrose path of paper contracts.
Ron, one more time. Let's get your telephone number out before we go to the break.
That's 1-800-595-0561.
One more time.
1-800-595-0561.
Okay, Frank, hang on there for just a minute. We'll be right back. Frank, do you have anything else to say? And I would echo what Ron has said. They have all these gimmicks out there, and they're designed to take away your life savings. Anything else?
Yeah, is it what could be good for someone like me? Because I don't want to have gold in my house because somebody might
Well, you could always put it in the safety deposit box. But basically, you certainly you do not want to be playing the market. I think gold is probably going to go up. I could be wrong. But the one thing is, it'll always have value in relationship to the things that you want to buy. If you are retired, you do not want to be gambling at this stage, because if you make a mistake, you'll never recoup it. Ron, what would you respond to, Frank?
I would just, in fact, I'll just repeat what I've said on your show a jillion times, Dr. Stan. What I tell people is, at this point in time, silver is not only the greatest investment you have ever had or will ever have in your lifetime. It quite literally, at this point in time, is the greatest investment of world history. Now, as bodacious as that sounds, let me put it in perspective. Most of your experts would tell you that you couldn't come up with a billion ounces of silver if you had to. At $30 an ounce, that's $30 billion to buy all the silver in the world. Keep in mind that silver is already spoken for, and the people who own it are less and less likely to want to sell it as they watch the system unravel. And yet here we have just our Federal Reserve creating $85 billion every month. In other words, they're printing enough money every month just at the U.S. Fed to buy up two times the world supply of silver. And that's why there's a lot of experts that will tell you, when this fraud is exposed, that all this paper silver people think they have is nothing but paper, that you could see $500 or $1,000 silver. So silver, in my opinion, is the best refuge to protect yourself from what's coming down.
Okay, Frank, that's just Ron's view, and I think that I'm sort of a half and half. Ron is very, very strongly in favor of silver, and he's probably right. Anything else, Frank?
Would you put silver dollars in your safety deposit box, or would it be an Australian silver mine that you could buy?
No.
Well, keep in mind, when you put it in a safety deposit box, in effect, you're asking the fox to guard your hen house because you're buying the gold and silver to protect yourself from a fraudulent banking system. So if you put it in a safety deposit box, I'm not going to tell you not to. Just be monitoring what's going on and be ready to go down and get it on a moment's notice. Don't store your gold or silver way out of your hand where you can't get to it.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly our guest has been Ron Brown for this last hour. Frank, very much appreciate your calling, and just keep
right
on listening, okay? And because, Ron, do you have a parting thought before we let you go?
Well, you know, I think people just have to understand that the debt system is trying to collapse, and the bankers and the politicians have to use every dirty trick in the book to keep that system from collapsing. One of the things they have to do is hold the price of gold and silver down and create the illusion of prosperity. If you pump enough new money into the system, it's going to drive the stock market up. Then you have the Wall Street saying how the economy is improving. The economy isn't improving. But if you pump a bunch of money and it goes into stocks, it creates the illusion that things are getting better, but in reality they aren't. So while they're doing that, the kings of the East, people around the world, are losing faith in the dollar. They're exchanging their dollars for gold and silver, and the gold and silver is leaving this country just unbelievably fast. And if people don't wake up before it happens, they're going to decide, oh, I need to buy some gold and silver, and it's not going to be there. You're already having very tight situation in bags of silver. The Mint was running out of ability to deliver the silver eagles two or three times in the last several months. So the available supplies are getting very, very tight. And people need to understand, you're not buying gold and silver with the same paradigm. It's not to make money. You're trying to get your life savings out of harm's way before the whole system collapses.
We're going to have to let you go. We're out of time. God bless, Ron, and thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye. And, of course, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I need to remind our listeners, my ministry, Radio Liberty's primarily listener-supported. And if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, give us a call of 1-800-544-8927. And then I have to remind you, this is the last time I'm going to be offering a case of my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. You can get a case, 64 copies of my book, for a suggested gift of $149.95. And then, of course, you're going to have to pay shipping, but we'll be glad to give you a free 4-CD set, a free DVD to help defray that cost. And basically, we're going to start printing next week. And so after Sunday, they're not taking any more offers. So we will start printing by Monday or Tuesday. So if you want to get them, you're going to have to call. I will tell you, we've had over 20 orders for 20 cases of the last 2 days. And so basically, we're way over the top of what we anticipated. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. I'm sorry, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. If you want to get a case of the books and you can give them away, why, you can suddenly sell them. You can actually lend them. We prefer you lend them. And that way the person has an obligation to read it, because this book can change their lives. And it has changed the lives and outlook of many people, because, of course, it stresses that we're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield. So if you want to get a case of the books, you're going to actually have to call, and it's going to have to be today or tomorrow. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. It'll help Radio Liberty, but more than that, it'll help you to help others. It's a weapon to use in this truly ideological battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. Is Christian civilization going to survive? Well, Christianity is going to survive, but I'm not certain that America will ever be as it was when I was growing up. The powerful, sinister forces, subversive forces that have seized control of the central government. We have the little group called the Trilateral Commission, and between 1977 and the year 2008, every president and or vice president, Democrat or Republican, came from the membership rolls of that organization. There's only less than 80 members of the North American chapter. And yet, of course, when Barack Obama became president, he picked 11 or 12 of them to become his personal advisors, and they held the highest positions in the Obama administration. And now, of course, the new Secretary of Treasury, John Kerry, comes from the organization. Susan Rice, who's going to be becoming a national security advisor, she comes from the same organization. She's been UN ambassador. The same people, they simply change positions, but it's always the same people really running things. Our number, 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for America, but pray for Radio Liberty, our provision, and our protection.
Let us all be grateful for a land so fair. As we raise our voices in a solemn prayer, God bless America.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality and not illusion or delusion that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and well, hopefully for the next hour, they're going to be the views of William Grigg, who is formerly the senior editor of the New American Magazine, of course, for a time, the editor of Republic Magazine. I certainly, he writes a blog. He actually writes the Radio News Liberty newsletter. In fact, we got a letter just today from a gentleman who reads our newsletter and just said how much he enjoyed the newsletter. Maybe he didn't understand I don't write it any longer. You can go up to our website, radioliberty.com, and look at all the newsletters that I did write over a 15 or 18 year period. But right now, William Grigg writes the Radio Liberty newsletter, and we appreciate that because it gives me time to do other things that we need to do to keep Radio Liberty afloat and going, and certainly to get advertisers and all the things that are necessary to maintain a network with over 50 outlets every week. But William certainly has a blog, and he'll be telling you how to get onto his blog, how to get the various things that he writes. You'll find him writing very, very frequently for Lou Rockwell, which is certainly one of the best known of the conservative blog sites out here. And certainly LouRockwell.com carries Lou's Williams articles on a regular basis, and certainly if you want to keep abreast of what's really going on, go to William Grigg's website and read his articles. I think you'll find them fascinating, and I hope that William's going to be with us in just a moment or two here. But certainly I always look forward to our Friday evenings as we get a chance to talk with William and get his analysis of what's really going on in America, because I think he's one of the most articulate and certainly a reliable spokesman as he analyzes what's taking place across our nation as we turn our back on our traditions, as ever more power is centralized with the government, as this small group of what I call evil and wicked people who really are running things consolidate their power and certainly are looking for any justification to centralize all power with the federal police force. And that's just the direction we're heading. We're heading into a dictatorship where freedom, as you and I have noted, will soon be only a remembrance of things past. William, it's good to have you with us tonight.
Dr. Stan, thank you so much for having me as a guest again. It's always a blessing and a privilege.
Well, what are we going to be talking about tonight?
I'd like to play off of what you just said in the last few sentences of your introduction here about the consolidation of power and the de facto dictatorship that we confront. Many people assume that if you have a dictator, you don't have a democracy, as if these things are incompatible. Of course, there are plentiful examples of people who have acquired power democratically and become dictators. Adolf Hitler didn't win a general election, but he was elevated to power through democratic means in a constitutional republic that was, I think the proper word would be cursed, with the charter of government that permitted the executive, the chancellor, to suspend the Constitution in the event of a national emergency. That power had been exercised during the 1920s, which was a somewhat tempestuous period in post-war Germany where you had totalitarians of the right and left battling in the streets. And of course, once he came to power, within a couple of years, he'd consolidated power. And 5 or 6 years later, he was at the head of a party-directed unitary government that in many respects is similar, eerily similar to the one that we're confronting today, despite our constitutional heritage.
But the thing is that so many of the German people rallied behind him, basically. The economy started to do well, so they were taking back the countries, the nations that had been taken away from them by the Treaty of Versailles. And the German people as a whole fully supported Adolf Hitler, without realizing, of course, where it was going to lead. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. William, you go right ahead.
What you say about the cultural consensus on behalf of the government under Adolf Hitler in Germany in the 1930s, early 1930s, in any case, is tragically true. And this was something that had been manipulated into existence by Mr. Hitler and the people who supported him. He was very much a product of the same subterranean forces we're confronting today. He was a beneficiary of a great deal of support from this covert brotherhood that you refer to, Dr. Stan, in terms of Wall Street supporting and financing the rise of the war machine in Germany while extracting every advantage it could from the reparations that have been imposed on Germany that created the cultural circumstances that were congenial to the rise of a totalitarian nationalist movement. They really were covering the spectrum here. They impoverished and immiserated Germany. Of course, right after World War One, you had a starvation embargo that was clamped down on Germany by the vindictive powers of England and France particularly. And these people who came back from the front lines, who were war veterans, had seen horrible things, the war that was manifestly pointless and stupid, more so than most wars in history. Most wars, of course, are pointless and stupid enterprises of mass murder and a completely avoidable mayhem. But they came back, and they were confronted with the prospect of starvation. And that element of the military, those war veterans, were the most receptive to the National Socialist Movement, which really had gestated in the slums of Bohemia. It was a countercultural movement that was deeply rooted in really bizarre, flaky mysticism and sexual degeneracy. And most Germans didn't want to have anything to do with that movement. And when Adolf Hitler appeared on the scene in the early 1930s, he was such a risible figure who reeked of things that were unsavory and disreputable that most people wanted nothing to do with him. The common caricature of him was that he looked like a male prostitute, and not the type of male prostitute to be the consort of a middle-aged woman, but rather the type of male prostitute who'd be playing for the other side. And during the late part of World War One, when he was part of the military intelligence apparatus in Germany, he'd been known as Adolf the Red because he would harangue people on the front lines in tropes and terms that were very similar to the Marxist revolutionary themes that were voiced by the Marxist left in Germany. And he was the person who became reconfigured. He was rebranded into supposedly the champion of the middle class. This really was a masterpiece of propaganda, and it took place within a very few years.
Hold that thought, and we'll be right back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly William is talking about what happened in Germany following the First World War, which was a totally senseless war. And if you've read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you'll realize it was totally contrived. There was no reason for the war. The Germans tried to end the war, and to avoid the war completely, tried to have peace negotiations in 1915, but the small little cabal that controlled England and the United States at that time wanted this to become a world war, and out of the horror of that conflict would come this one world government. That's what it was all about. But of course, everybody went into the League of Nations except the United Nations, pardon me, except the United States. The United States hadn't been bad enough hurt. We hadn't seen our sons and daughters killed by the millions as they did in England and France and throughout Europe, and where 8 million military people died, 21 million people altogether in a totally senseless war. And England and France, everybody was willing to go into this world government, the League of Nations. But America wasn't, and so it didn't it didn't succeed. So then World War II became inevitable, just as today World War III is inevitable, because that will bring us into the world government. That's what it's all about. But basically, of course, William's talking about how Hitler came to power and in post-war, World War I Germany, where people were certainly facing starvation that destroyed the economy, that killed off so many of the young people in a totally senseless war. And people were looking for a leader who would make them feel proud to be Germans again, because everything had been done to humiliate them by the Allies. And it wasn't a war that they wanted. The Allies had created this war, and the Germans had been manipulated into negotiating a temporary surrender. And of course, it was a great plague that came along. Remember, the influenza killed more people than were actually killed in the war itself. 21 million people died from the war, and 21 million people died from the Great Flu. And Europe was decimated by the influenza epidemic at that time. Well, anyway, go right ahead. Pick up the story, William.
That's a part of this story that many people don't appreciate. The so-called Spanish flu was a huge problem. It was a apocalyptic plague here in the United States, but also, of course, over in Europe. And that's, of course, one of the illustrations of a timeless truth that you have four horsemen of the apocalypse, and, you know, war, famine, pestilence, and I believe starvation is, or famine, I think starvation is the same thing, but there are four fellow travelers, if you will, and pestilence or disease is very much a part of that package. And every time you have war, you have all kinds of pathologies proliferate, both physically and morally. And you can really trace the decline in American public morality and private morality from our involvement in World War One. They used to say, how do you keep them on the farm once they've seen Paris, once they've been in an enabling condition where they can express impulses that are usually restrained by personal morality and social discipline? That's one of the things that happens in war. That changes people. That has radiating consequences for society. We didn't have a lost generation in the same sense that England or France or Belgium or certainly Germany did. But we had a generation that was infected with nihilism, and it became a highly communicable strain once they returned to the United States. And at the same time, you had this movement toward totalitarianism in Russia and in Germany and in Central Europe, and you had these revolutionary forms of nationalism begin to ulcerate the Balkans and what had been the Ottoman Empire. Here in the United States, you had 10 years of materialistic abandon in which quietly the people who had orchestrated that war began to consolidate power. That war was part of a symphony that was scored and rehearsed for a number of decades, but 100 years ago exactly, 1913, was really a fracture point where we were put on this course of foreign intervention and domestic consolidation of power with the advent of the income tax, the Federal Reserve, and other elements of what's now called the progressive agenda. And by 1933, 1934, you had functionally totalitarian powers, or rather, functionally totalitarian governments in power in much of Europe and in the United States. I would consider the FDR regime to be a regime and not a government under constitutional law, as we had previously seen, because, among other things, they were distributing among the brain trust the writings of Giovanni Gentile, who was one of the chief theoreticians of fascism in Mussolini's Italy. And they started with the premise, FDR and his cohorts, that what the Constitution didn't explicitly forbid was permitted. In other words, if they weren't told by the Constitution they could do something, they should assume that they had the power to do the thing in question. And that included making FDR our first president for life, which was a matter of custom up until that point. There was a matter of custom that restrained presidents from seeking more than two terms. But FDR, of course, was somebody who considered himself not beholden to the written law, so why should custom deter him? But from 1945 till now, we've lived under a rudimentary form of executive-dominated military rule. And this is something that is becoming more overt just in the last couple of weeks with the filibuster on the part of Rand Paul, the Brennan nomination, and the badly overdue discussion of arbitrary killing by the president, extrajudicial killing, presidential assassination, which has always been, as you pointed out, a covert element of the government that's been imposed on us, is now being openly discussed. What I find most unsettling about this conversation is the assumption here that the Congress, as Eric Holder, the Attorney General, said in a Senate Judiciary Committee meeting, the Congress cannot restrain the president from doing this. Not only is the president entitled to order the summary execution of people he considers to be enemies of the state or militants or terrorist suspects, but there's no law under heaven and no institution, no countervailing force within the federal government that can stop him from doing this, that he has plenary authority up to and including the power to order summary execution. That's the state of the conversation now about our civic culture. And any ruler who claims that power and exercises it, as Mr. Obama does every single week, and as he has done on many occasions, I would say that four or five occasions will be many for the purposes of this discussion, against U.S. citizens, is a dictator, albeit one who's not persistently and consistently exercising the full panoply of his dictatorial powers. In principle and increasingly in practice, you have a dictatorship. And it doesn't matter whether you're talking about a Republican or a Democrat. It doesn't matter whether you're talking about somebody who professes to be liberal or conservative. Whoever occupies that office right now and claims those powers, does not consciously repudiate them, is going to be further entrenching the powers of dictatorship. And even more unsettling to me, Dr. Stan, is the fact that over the last couple of weeks, in addition to the discussion about arbitrary killing by the president, we've had our good friends at the Southern Poverty Law Center, so-called, and the Homeland Security Department talking about making a pivot from dealing with foreign enemies in the never-ending war on terror to focusing on restive internal elements, extremists and anti-government radicals, who will, for instance, be discussing in terms similar to the ones we're using this evening, the prospect of the government overtly making war against the United States citizenry. And this reminds me, as I recently wrote in my blog, this reminds me a great deal of something that happened in the early 1980s when the government of communist East Germany arrested a number of human rights activists who held a press conference to denounce restrictions on free speech in communist East Germany. They were arrested and thrown into prison by the Stasi, the secret police, and the government of, I believe it was Erich Honecker at the time, said that the reason this was done is because they had been saying in public that the government would repress freedom of speech, and the government, of course, was being defamed by this speech, and that was impermissible. So they were arrested for exercising their freedom of speech to condemn restrictions on freedom of speech. We've got a similar dynamic taking place right now, taking shape right now in the United States, where people who say that the government of the United States is acting tyrannically are looked upon as anti-government elements and subversive elements that must be dealt with very severely. Because by saying such things, we're supposedly arraying ourselves in a hostile stance, in a type of militant confrontational posture toward the federal government. You're probably familiar with Louise Slaughter. She's appropriately named Democratic congresswoman from New York who for a couple of decades has been promoting a civilian disarmament agenda. She was interviewed on Al Gore's Current TV, which, of course, practically nobody watches, which means that people like her can indulge themselves in unusual candor when they're speaking amongst themselves.
I think they recently sold it to Al Jazeera, the Muslims organization. Go ahead.
But she was being interviewed about the impending gun grab, and she made a comment to the effect that people who believe that they can hold off the United States government with AR-15 should take a look at the size of the military budget of the United States government. Now, that's something that I find profoundly disconcerting, because that's very close to an overt threat to wage war against the American people, which just happens to meet the strict constitutional definition of treason. Treason consists of making war upon the small u, united, capital S, states. That is to say, the sovereign states that created the constitutional union and the people who were represented by those state governments. So when you have a congressman who's supposedly an anti-gun violence advocate, overtly threatening, albeit in somewhat elusive fashion, to use the might of the United States military to put down domestic dissent, we've really reached an interesting turn in the evolution or the devolution of the United States from our constitutional republic into whatever it is that we're becoming, which is something closely akin in many ways to some of the classic totalitarian societies we've seen in history. I don't think that Joseph Stalin actually had as much discretionary power to kill by decree as Barack Obama claims. He actually went through the facade of legal process before he can sign people to death. Barack Obama can simply do it on a whim.
Well, but I don't think it's just Barack Obama. I think our previous presidents have done exactly the same thing. We never like to talk about George W. Bush doing that sort
of thing.
That's true. But he was certainly giving permission for them to kill people with the CIA. Go right ahead.
Well, not merely George W. Bush, but George H.W. Bush was in that business as the head of the CIA. And some of the things that happened during the Reagan administration, of course, need to be examined much more carefully, as is the case with what happened during the Johnson administration and the Nixon administration. I mean, as you've like pointed out, Dr. Stan, the people who are running this show are a self-perpetuating oligarchy, and the president, whoever he happens to be, is their figurehead. He's somebody who's used as their cat paw. And for decades, we've had presidents who have not scrupled to order covert assassinations, what we would call contract hits, if they were carried out by private criminal syndicates rather than by officially sanctioned political criminal syndicates. But again, what I find really striking and alarming about this is the fact that this is being discussed so openly. And I've mentioned before that over the last couple of weeks, I've been rereading Solzhenitsyn. I think the tenor of our times makes that study appropriate. And in the sections of that book dealing with the secret police, with the blue caps, the KGB, which was called the NKVD at the time, and specifically the institutionalization of torture, there are some really potent parallels and some very compelling resonances with what's happening today in the United States, because it talks about the fact that in the 1920s, when the Soviet regime was consolidating power over Russia, this took a number of years, obviously. I mean, the NKVD, at the time it was called Cheka, was really the first institution they established and the most important one. It took a while to consolidate its grip. But between 1918 or so, when the Cheka was newly minted, and the emergence of Stalin as the primus inter pares of the ruling oligarchy, there was a 5 or 6 year period when the subject of torture and summary detention and executive execution, these themes were actually debated in the media, in the press. They didn't have radio to speak of at the time. This meant that most of these subjects were addressed through newspapers, periodicals of that kind, and some of the scholarly publications that hadn't been fully assimilated by the Bolshevik regime were still publishing dissenting views of some issues. So there was some mild dissent on the part of people who were paying attention. And the question was whether the Bolsheviks represented something new or if they were simply refinement of what had happened before in Russian history. We need to take a look at people like Ivan the Terrible with his Oprichniki secret police. That's a word, if I remember correctly, from the Russian that refers to the outsiders. Their insignia, if I remember correctly, was a broom, an iron broom, because they would sweep the kingdom clean of all dissenting elements. There is this strain in Russian history that represents severe authoritarianism and discretionary killing. But what people didn't realize, Solzhenitsyn said, is that there was even then, even in the depths of authoritarian terror in medieval Russia and Russia in the late Middle Ages and the early modern era, there was still a sense of restraint because these people, to put the matter bluntly, still believed in God. They believed that there would be a judgment day. They believed that they would answer to somebody whose authority transcended that of any terrestrial government. And they still believed that they had moral obligations to restrain themselves in the exercise of power. The Bolsheviks labored under no such compunction. And once they had consolidated power, they set out with the nihilistic intention of destroying every competing source of social authority, every intermediating institution that would buffer the individual against the inroads and the...
Hold that thought. Well, certainly, Dr. Stan, we were simply talking about Solzhenitsyn's view that certainly under the Tsars, why, of course, there was power, but that power was circumscribed and certainly limited because people believed in God. And if they knew that certainly if they abused their power, one day they would have to stand before God to justify what they'd done. Whereas, of course, once the Bolsheviks came in and there was no belief in God, why, of course, there were no restraints at all on anything. And, of course, this is the tragedy in America. We've taken God out of our schools and prayer out of our schools and the Ten Commandments out of our schools and Christmas celebrations and certainly Easter celebrations. And certainly the Supreme Court repudiates God, even though they have a copy of the Ten Commandments sitting engraved in the stone above where the Supreme Court justices sit, and the Ten Commandments is inscribed on the door of the room that they sit in. But you see, we put people into positions of power who hate God. Because if you get down to the very essence of what's going on, what we're dealing with is a conspiracy against God. We can talk about conspiracies of communism and Marxism and socialism, but it's really a conspiracy against God. When you understand that, why, you can begin to understand what's going on today. When you actually, if you haven't yet gone up on the internet and gone to Google and typed in YouTube, Obama, My Muslim Faith, YouTube, Obama, My Muslim Faith. Go there and listen to President Obama talk about how he's so grateful that John McCain hasn't criticized his or made an issue of his Muslim faith. This is the man who's the President of the United States, and the fact that you, no question at all, he's immediately corrected by the person who's interviewing him. Oh, yes, yes, my Christian faith, that's right, my Christian faith. And then he smiles, sort of that sort of half a smile that he has when he's been caught in a lie. Go ahead.
I've often referred to that as his coprophagous grin, and that's a term that some people might be familiar with. It's not particularly complimentary. I think what faith he has is faith in collectivism, by whatever means he's arrived at it, whether it's a certain type of adulterated liberation theology of nominally Christian provenance, or if it's the equivalent of the Muslim faith. And of course you have Marxists who have infiltrated Muslim faith communities over the last 100 years or so and have used those as the vehicle to bring about the transformation of the Muslim religion into a really potent, weaponized type of Marxist or Marxist nationalist ideology. And the same things happen with a number of strains of Christianity, most notably, of course, Latin American Catholicism. But however he got there, it's pretty clear that Mr. Obama is a cultural Marxist. He doesn't recognize that there are any limits to his power. It's interesting. A couple of weeks ago, he made some comment to the effect that I'm not a dictator. I can't lock the doors in the course of budget negotiations and forbid Representative Boehner, Representative Cantor from leaving and catching their plane. Now, it's interesting because that's, to the best of my knowledge, the first time that Obama has said that there's something he couldn't do. And he was talking, of course, about budget negotiations and restraining the movement of people who are also part of the ruling elite, part of the political class. But when it comes to the exercise of power against those of us who are in the productive sector, those of us who are private citizens who are not part of the federal apparatus, there really is nothing that Mr. Obama recognizes as beyond his discretionary power, which is why he claims the authority through the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act of 2011 and 2012, to detain people indefinitely, while promising us that he would never exercise that power. But his administration, working on behalf of the people who placed Obama in power, I hasten to specify, has gone before federal courts to to have a permanent injunction against enforcement of that detention power lifted. And in doing so, they've made very broad and extravagant claims of discretionary power on the part of the executive while refusing to answer questions about how that power would be used. They claim the power, but they promised that they wouldn't exercise it. Well, if they wouldn't exercise it, they shouldn't be claiming it. And at the same time, you've had the same kind of studious coyness on behalf of Eric Holder and on behalf of John Brennan and General Clapper at the NSA and Robert Mueller at the FBI regarding the question of using drones to kill U.S. citizens here on the soil of the United States. Now, the president doesn't have the authority to kill anybody on his say-so, whether you're talking about a U.S. citizen or somebody who's a citizen of a foreign country, or to use those death-dealing machines anywhere against civilians. But it's really interesting that we've reached a point where they will not specifically disavow the use of these drones or other means to carry out summary executions on American soil. They will simply not answer the question.
But they have done it in Yemen. They've killed an innocent 16-year-old boy with no history of terrorism. And basically, of course, what Holder said was that they would not kill Americans, you know, or certainly non-combatants. Well, but they never defined what a combatant is. Is a combatant, like the gentleman they killed in Yemen, somebody who spoke out against America? Because, of course, those of us who are critical of what's going on could be considered as combatants, just like the man that they killed in Yemen.
While a storm cloud gathers far across the sea, let us swear allegiance to a land that's free.
Well, William, you go right ahead.
People don't understand how easily somebody can be designated a combatant. Anwar al-Awlaki, as we've said before, is somebody who is a radical cleric whose religion I do not support and whose politics I do not consider to be wholesome. He's somebody who had spoken out in defense of insurgent warfare and partisan warfare against U.S. military occupation of Muslim countries overseas. And he did so in terms that were very confrontational and perhaps too bellicose to be helpful. He talked about the fact that you can't expect American civilians to be spared the malign attentions and the retaliatory violence of Muslims if you have Muslim civilians being killed by the U.S. military and by the CIA and by proxies throughout the Middle East. And I don't think that he ever said that this is a good thing. He said it was a predictable thing. The point is that between 1999 and the time of his murder, no other word is suitable, in 2011, he was repeatedly investigated by the FBI, by the CIA. He was at one point arrested and detained in Yemen by the government of Yemen, a horrible dictatorship that's a catspaw for Washington, and held for a number of months. There was never a criminal case made against him, and he was accessible for the purpose of arresting and arraigning and trying in an adversarial setting in a civilian court. On several occasions, the FBI had dismissed the case against him, saying there was no evidence that he was involved in terrorism. And so making an example of Anwar al-Awlaki is a serious marker here, a very important test case and precedent for the type of thing that the Obama administration and its successors, if any, would be willing to do.
Well, I think that what bothers me is this man had never been indicted for a crime.
Yeah.
Basically, you have to have a certain amount of evidence, but he could have been indicted, and he should have certainly been put before a court, but he wasn't even indicted.
He could have been
there was
tried
no
in
evidence.
Absentia.
Right, and basically, suddenly, if you don't certainly indict somebody, how can you simply go out and kill them because you think that maybe what they've said is anti-American? Well, that's freedom of speech. Or have we limited freedom of speech? Well, they tell us we're at war, but who are we at war with? Terror? Go ahead.
Yeah, how can we be at war with a state of mind or a tactic? But that, of course, is something else Solzhenitsyn talks about, is the fact that under Stalin, this mechanism of social control had become dependent on the identity, the identification, rather, of enemies. There always had to be new enemies to fight in order to justify the type of power that Stalin and his clique exercised against their subject people.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest William Grigg, and he's simply talking about Solzhenitsyn and Solzhenitsyn's writing about the Soviet Union and how they justified the things that they did. They had to have a justification for the extermination of people to justify their dictatorship. Always had to be done in the name of securing the freedom of the people. Go ahead.
And that's, of course, a very familiar proposition to those of us who've actually studied what's been going on near the United States. Now, when I talk about the administration of Obama as Stalinist, and I compare Eric Holder to the official who had been the equivalent of the Attorney General under Stalin, a man by the name of Krylenko, there are a number of people who take serious offense. I had a long debate with a Justice Department lawyer of all the unlikely people as to whether I was engaging in irresponsible hyperbole when I made that comparison. What's interesting here is that by engaging in that type of hyperbole, I could actually be considered a combatant on the basis of the precedents that have been set now. When I talk about the regime under Obama, when I use that term, for instance, to describe his administration, when I talk about that regime exercising Stalinist powers, I could be accused of seditious libel. And this is something that the government of the United States is taking very seriously now. When you see that somebody like Anwar al-Awlaki can be designated a combatant on the basis of the words that he has spoken and published, we recognize here that there can be immediate consequences of a very negative fashion for people who engage in that type of anti-government rhetoric. And I happen to believe that anti-government rhetoric is our longest and proudest and most vital free speech tradition. But in this discussion with the State Department lawyer, I pointed out that what matters is not the body count which has been rolled up, but the powers that are being claimed and exercised. And the fact that, like Stalin, Mr. Obama does not recognize any limits on his power, and he considers himself not only qualified, but authorized by some agency or by disincarnate history to make these determinations and to enforce them at his whim. And I also pointed out something that I think made her even angrier. And that is that if you look at the Justice Department, not the Justice Department, forgive me, the State Department's country report on Cuba for 2011, and the country report, of course, includes a human rights report, when it describes Cuba as a totalitarian military dictatorship, it itemizes the various abuses that are attendant to that status. And one of them is extrajudicial killings or arbitrary killings. In the year 2011, this is something I found quite surprising given the nature of that regime in Cuba, there were no recorded extrajudicial or arbitrary killings by security forces in Cuba. But there were several that involved American citizens carried out by the Obama regime. And there were hundreds, if not thousands, carried out involving citizens of foreign countries, particularly Pakistan. It had become institutionalized by 2011, this process of arbitrary killing by remote control, and you had no fewer than three U.S. citizens, including a 16-year-old child, who were murdered on the orders of the President of the United States by remote control. These are extrajudicial arbitrary killings of the sort that are a hallmark of a totalitarian regime.
Now, you're talking about, of course, the drone attacks in Pakistan, which have killed, what, 200 or 300 people during the last year. Go ahead.
Yeah, easily 200 or 300 people. And many of these attacks are, as we've noted before, double strike or double tap strikes, where you have a drone come by and fire a Hellfire missile and take out a target or take out a location where a target is thought to be. That's a very important matter here, is that they've not narrowed it down with such precision that they know where these people are at all times. They, for the most part, use a very coarsely tuned system of pattern of life analysis to determine who is and who is not a militant. I'll have a little bit more to say about that here in just a second as it applies to what happens in Afghanistan and what's going on here in the United States. But they will take out an area where a suspected militant is believed to be and then wait 15 or 20 minutes for first responders and emergency personnel to show up, and then fire a second missile. And this, of course, is a time-dishonored terrorism tactic, the sort of thing that was used by, among other people, the IRA in the 1970s, and been used domestically by people who are recognized as domestic terrorists. Eric Rudolph, for instance, was notorious for setting what he called breaks, or what are called breaks, rather, where you have a bomb, a primary bomb, then you have a secondary bomb that is detonated within a very brief period of time. You anticipate the reaction of the people to the first bomb. It's a little like a track two razor effect, where you have two blades that take out a whisker.
But William, how in the world can they justify that? Because they know that the people are going to be killing with the second bomb will be the responders, the people, you know, from the people from the hospital, the fire department. These are non-combatants. Why would they fire a second shot to kill innocent civilians?
Yeah.
Unless, of course, they're trying to antagonize the people of Pakistan intentionally and purposely so they can generate more terrorists.
And what a wonderful strategy that is, dealing with the one country in the region that could end up descending into a fundamentalist Islamic totalitarian regime that would have a nuclear arsenal. You're dealing with a nuclear power here that's profoundly unstable socially. And they're pursuing a strategy which is perfectly calculated to alienate the public of that country, and they've been wildly successful in doing so. That's the eminently predictable outcome of what they're doing. And these people are many things, most of them contemptible, but the word stupid isn't on that list. They're intelligent enough to realize that people are living under the threat, the perpetual threat of death from the sky that's carried out by an inaccessible and prohibitively powerful foreign regime. They're going to turn against that foreign enemy. And so they're cultivating terrorism. They're sowing the seeds from which a bloody harvest will spring within a few years. Okay, so what's going to happen is we're probably going to have some kind of an intermission, or at least some kind of a de-escalation of the overseas conflicts, perhaps. We might end up with a full-scale shooting war in Iran, or maybe a full-scale shooting war in the Korean Peninsula. But they'll probably downplay that for the next few years and then redirect their focus on what's going on here in the United States, taking the lessons that they have learned here from this decade-long so-called counterinsurgency war. And one of the architects of COIN, counterinsurgency, was David Petraeus at the CIA. He's been eased out to make room for John Brennan, who was the keeper of the kill list, one of the architects of the drone killing policy. But another architect of COIN is General Stanley McChrystal, who was put in charge of joint operations in Afghanistan and actually presided over most of what was going on internationally in counterinsurgency warfare. He just had a lengthy interview published in Foreign Affairs, which is a, of course, profoundly important publication that is produced by an immensely powerful organization called the Council on Foreign Relations. If you want to know what the group that you refer to as the Brotherhood of Darkness is up to and what they consider to be a priority, it's a good idea to check Foreign Affairs. That's one of the definitive publications to let us know what these people are thinking. And in this interview, he's talking about what happened when he took over in 2003 as the head of counterinsurgency. He talked about the fact that they had a network in Joint Special Operations Command that was involved, at one point, in 27 countries simultaneously. Now, that's a fairly large chunk of the world where you had counterinsurgency operations going on that were presided over by Joint Special Operations Command. Inside Iraq, he said, we were in 20 and 30 places simultaneously, all connected using modern technology, but also personal relationships. This gave us the ability to learn about the constantly evolving challenge. People hear most about the targeting cycle, continued General McChrystal, which we called 4-3-E-A, as in find, fix, finish, exploit, and analyze. You understand who or what is a target, you locate it, you capture or kill it, you take what intelligence you can from people or equipment or documents, you analyze that, and then you go back and do the cycle again, only smarter. When we first started, those five steps were performed by different parts of our organization or different security agencies, and as a consequence, each time you passed information from one to another, it would be like a game of telephone, so that by the time information got to the end, it would not only slow, but also be corrupted. We learned we had to reduce the number of steps in the process. Then he talks about the way that they went about refining their process of collecting information, intelligence, and carrying out this self-sustaining process of what he called, once again, find, fix, finish, exploit, and analyze. By the way, Bradley Manning was involved in this, and one of the reasons why he did this huge document dump was that he came to understand by examining the intelligence that this was a procedure that was not doing anything to make U.S. troops safer, not doing anything to make life better for Iraqis, but it was creating enemies and it was killing hundreds and thousands of perfectly innocent people. And what McChrystal said here is we could capture someone, gain intelligence from the experience, go after someone else, and do three of those in a row, the second two involving people we didn't even know existed at the beginning of the night. In August 2004, in all of Iraq, our task force did 18 raids. We thought that was breakneck speed, but as great as those 18 raids were, they couldn't make a dent in the exploding insurgency. 2 years later, in August 2006, we were up to 300 raids a month. That's interesting, 300 raids a month, where 18 raids a month had been a breakneck speed. Within 2 years, they'd refined that process to that extent. Up to 300 raids a month, 10 a night. This meant the network now had to operate at the speed that was not even considered before, not in our wildest dreams. It had to have decentralized decision-making because you can't centralize 10 raids a night. You have to understand them all, but you also have to allow your subordinate elements to operate very quickly.
And I think it's important that people understand you're talking about Green Beret SEALs, these highly trained, very specialized special forces. Go ahead.
Yes. What's happened here is that they refined a system that is going to be used domestically. Now, let me run back very quickly the pedigree of SWAT teams. I think I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago, Dr. Stan, but I just discovered, and I don't know why it took me so long to do so, that the first SWAT teams were not organized in Los Angeles in 1968, as I had always assumed. They were actually organized in Vietnam by what would be called the direct ancestor of the Green Berets in 1959. The SWAT teams were paramilitary special purpose police squads that were organized within the friendly element of the Vietnamese government to conduct raids against suspected insurgents and radicals and agitators and so forth. They perfected this style of organization and the tactics that were used in what would later be called the Phoenix Program. And less than 10 years later, under Darrell Gates, the LAPD, you had that same model being adopted for domestic use. 3 years later, after the war on drugs was declared, you had SWAT teams begin to proliferate across the length and breadth of the United States. I remember in the mid-1970s, there was a television program that I quite liked as a teenager called SWAT. It was basically an hour-long infomercial for these domestic paramilitary teams that were the embryo of what would become a standing army of occupation. By now, practically every police department of any size, anywhere in the country has a SWAT team, and it's gotten to the point where every police department, quite frankly, is a support apparatus for the SWAT team or the tactical team. Even, as I mentioned before, here in Payette, Idaho, there's a multi-agency SWAT team that's doing all kinds of things all the time that have nothing to do with response to hostage situations or armed robberies, things of that kind. The thing that has happened since 1995 is that they've all become affiliates of the Pentagon, and what's happening now is that they're being folded into this vertically integrated homeland security system that is going to take the lessons used and learned in counterinsurgency warfare in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere to deal with the domestic enemy being identified now by the Department of Homeland Security and by its deniable private asset, the Southern Poverty Law Center. They're going to apply, if not the specific tactics they used, they're going to apply the same techniques in terms of what McChrystal called, once again, find, fix, finish, exploit, and analyze. We already have a system now where they use provocateurs, and this has been done for the last decade, focusing primarily on Muslim Americans. They insinuate provocateurs into radical groups. They compromise people, and then in the fashion of a multi-level marketing scheme or pyramid scheme, they get these people to implicate others as a way of getting a better deal. This happens with the war on drugs. It also happens with the war on terrorism. It's been focusing on drug dealers and ethnic gangs and Muslims for the last 10 years, and it's going to, I believe, it's going to become a more common practice with so-called right-wing extremists. And it's not really going to be the old COINTELPRO type stings and scams and provocations and false flags. These things are going to become part of this industrial machine of regimentation and detention and arbitrary killing that was used by McChrystal and Petraeus in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere. This is, I suspect, what's going to be happening now. Beginning this year, we're going to see, I believe, a number of operations of this sort using a modified version of this counterinsurgency strategy here in the United States. they may not deploy the drones yet, but I have no doubt that right now they've already deployed people who are in the beginning phase of applying this system domestically to deal with so-called anti-government elements. So people need to be very circumspect, very judicious, not allow themselves to be caught in the undertow of subversion that is being generated by people who want to get this process going. Don't be seduced into doing things that are both stupid and illegal and immoral when you're trying to do something to fight back against the unfolding totalitarian mechanism that we're confronting here. By no means restrain yourself in condemning what's going on, but don't hesitate if somebody approaches you and covertly wants you to do something that you know is both stupid and immoral. Don't hesitate to identify that person as potentially somebody who's working on behalf of the same government whose actions you abhor. This is something you've talked about before, Dr. Stan. They do target congregations, religious congregations. They target activist groups. What's happening now is that they have dramatically escalated the process and made it much more potentially lethal and much more dangerous. And we're going to see a very severe escalation in the next couple of years. I'm completely convinced.
And let me point out, ladies and gentlemen, they have infiltrated all of our conservative organizations and even the largest and most, you know, certainly as best conservative organizations. They have their agents there. They're in the liberal organizations. They're in the churches and the Christian organizations. I know a number of these where the people I can identify who are there as government agents and are manipulating the leaders of the major Christian organizations. For instance, why do you think Dr. Dobson left Focus on the Family? I talked to him. I had an opportunity of talking to him and pointing out that his organization had been taken over and they were doing things he didn't even know about. And it wasn't too long after that when Dr. Dobson did leave Focus on the Family and set up his own organization. Why would he leave $100 million a year organization to form his own organization? This is not imaginary. Your best friend could be a government agent who's informing on you. Understand they have a system of informants all across America to protect our nation. Go right ahead, William.
Well, not to protect our nation, but to protect the interests of the people who have seized control of our nation.
I said that facetiously.
Yeah, William. I know.
I guess it's been... William, but, please go ahead and get your site out there so people would know how to get in touch with you.
Okay, freedominourtime.blogspot.com. It's called Pro Libertate. Just Google William N. Griggs. That'll be the first return. I have a PayPal button at the bottom of every essay, and I try to update that page once or twice a week.
Okay, we'll be back in just a moment and put that information out one more time. Well, William, I was so intrigued with everything you were talking about, I forgot the most important part, and that was getting out information on you, but we'll get it out after this break. You go right ahead.
I do appreciate that, Dr. Stan. Once again, Pro Libertate is the blog. freedominourtime.blogspot.com. is the direct address, freedominourtime.blogspot.com, or go to Google or a similar search engine and type in William N. Grigg, and Pro Libertate should be the first return. And I mentioned that I do have a PayPal account. The button's located at the bottom of every essay, and I really do appreciate all the help that we've received. There have been many people have been very generous to provide me and my family with support. This is our primary means of support for those who are interested in seeing what I do continue. That's something you can do to help. Anything is helpful. We do very much appreciate everything we receive. And I should point out as well that I've frequently published at lewrockwell.com, lewrockwell.com. And playing off of what you said, Dr. Stan, about the ubiquity of the problem we're dealing with here, I am of the opinion that if we're doing something that is manifestly right, we should be utterly fearless in doing so. And that means we have to check our motives. We have to examine everything we do in the light of what is good and true and commendable and godly. And it means that we have to be not merely as harmless as doves, but we have to be as wise as serpents. We have to understand the nature of the enemy we confront here. That doesn't mean that we turn against our friends and our family and our colleagues in a type of aversion to any kind of connection because of the fact that the government is honeycombing all of our associations with people who do not have our best interests in mind. It means that we do what is right defiantly but intelligently, and we do not allow ourselves to be seduced once again into doing something that is wrong. because we have been persuaded by somebody who's trying to entice us into something that would be compromising. We've been persuaded that the purity of our motives can justify actions that are morally unsupportable. And that's how the other side operates. They believe that because they're the embodiment of historical forces, they're not beholden to morality. Well, we are. And that's something that we have to remember. That's not only the smart thing to do, it's the right thing to do, to allow ourselves to be governed by inflexible moral principles. And if we do what's right, chances are good will come of it. And if it doesn't happen immediately, of course, our time preference is not so high that we can't recognize that there are rewards that will eventually be bestowed on us for doing what's right, even though it may not be the supposedly smart thing in the near term.
Well, our job is to do the best we can, realizing this is a spiritual battle. And certainly if we honor God, we do what is right. Hopefully he will look after us. We'll be back here in just one moment. William, Cynthia, would you one more time tell people how they can get to your website and get to your PayPal button, and then we'll let you get to bed.
All right. I do appreciate that. Pro Libertate is the name of the website. Pro Libertate, P-R-O-L-I-B-E-R-T-A-T-E. The direct address is Freedom in Our Time, as one word, freedominourtime.blogspot.com. freedominourtime.blogspot.com. The PayPal button is located at the bottom of every essay.
God bless you. Thanks so very much, and we'll talk to you again next week. And incidentally, we do need another newsletter one of these days. So
you'll be getting it over the weekend.
God bless. Okay, fine. Well, that's William Grigg. Always a pleasure to discuss, or let him certainly discuss what's going on, because he's one of the most astute observers we have. Well, this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that my ministry, Radio Liberty, is primarily listener-supported, and if you're in a position to help us, we'd love to hear from you. If you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And this is certainly the time, the last time we're going to be offering a case of our books, Radio Brotherhood of Darkness. You can get 64 copies of Brotherhood of Darkness for a suggested gift of $149.95 and plus shipping. And of course, we'll throw in if you ask for it, a free four CD set or a free DVD to help defray the cost of shipping. But it's vitally important, I think, that people actually have the book. You can lend it out, you can sell it. We suggest that you lend it to people. That way they have an obligation to read the book, and hopefully it will recruit them into this battle for which I and William, and I hope you are engaged, a battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. Right now, if I were to be a betting man, I'd say Christian civilization as we know it here in America is not going to survive, but of course Christianity will survive. Unfortunately, we may very well lose this country unless there's a great revival, and I really believe if enough people would read this book and understand what we're talking about, it could have an impact. At least it will have an impact on their lives. So if you'd like to get a case of the books, why, we're starting to print next first of next week. So this will be the last time I will be making the announcement. And we've actually had, I think 23 orders here in the last 2 days for cases of the book. So we've certainly gone over what we had anticipated. But that's all right. We'll just print more books because we want you to have the books. If you are in a position to get a case of books, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, if you'd like a free 4-CD set of DVD, just let us know what you want along with it. And then, of course, we do hope, if you've never heard my talk on Agenda 21, the covert plan, or on Population Control, the covert agenda, the DVDs, and, of course, they really rather well done. And they will give you the background to understand what is really going on in the world today. We have a talk, it's certainly my talk on the World Revolution. There you'll see my interview with Ambassador Earl Smith, the billionaire ambassador to Cuba at the time. We installed Fidel Castro. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, we installed Fidel Castro in Cuba. He didn't win the revolution. The Cuban people didn't want him. We installed him, And as Ambassador Smith will tell you, we knew he was a communist. The president knew he was a communist. The State Department knew he was a communist. The CIA knew he was a communist. And we installed Fidel Castro, but you're never going to be allowed to understand that. But maybe this will help to explain why David Rockefeller's daughters go down to visit Fidel. And Fidel comes up to visit David Rockefeller. If you doubt that, you need to get David Rockefeller's memoirs. We carry it. They're available by calling 1-800-544-8927. Why do you think David Rockefeller's daughters go down to visit the wicked Fidel Castro? Or maybe he's simply a creation of the Brotherhood of Darkness. And why does Fidel come up to visit David Rockefeller? The book Memoirs, available by calling 1-800-544-8927. And then we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival, for our leaders, for our ministers. But please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and for our protection. And so until Monday, we'll be back at the same time. May the Lord be with you.
Radio show, 15 March, halfway, almost through the first quarter of the year, first 3 months of the year. Thank you so very much for joining us today, caring about your world. Josh is back. Welcome, Josh, to the Power Hour.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, you are so welcome back, let me tell you. He does this family thing twice a year that, you know, I understand, but still... We do have our priorities. You understand that, Josh?
Yes, of course. Yes, it's good to be back.
Yes, we're glad to have you. We're going to be talking about lots of things today. Of course, the news, it seems to be getting worse. The potential war with North and South Korea, it does not look good. There are some, there is some breaking news on the war in South Korea that it just might be that they might be having... establishing a defensive posture there. So we will talk about that. A